want to talk about 1968, and not just because it's the 50th anniversary, though that always helps, but I don't know about you all, but I've noticed that the country isn't exactly delighted about the way things are going. I don't know if word has reached y'all, but my sense is that there's a good bit of public dispiritedness, no matter which side of the divide you're on, actually. If you voted to send the most unconventional major party nominee in American history to the White House in November of 2016, you were registering quite tangibly a lack of faith in the way things were going. If you voted against that unconventional nominee, who is now the 45th president, you probably, at some point in the last, say, 40 minutes, have considered lighting your hair on fire. Yeah. So, I am here to try to tell you that things have been worse, and we have survived. Not as a message to relax, but as a message to learn from those in the past who have struggled and overcome what I would argue are certainly equal and arguably far more difficult obstacles on the way, on the journey, toward a more perfect union. Because that's our goal. It's not perfection. It can't be perfection. The founders clearly saw that the best we could do was more perfect. And the Constitution, I swear to God, was written for this kind of moment. It was written because it assumed that we would try to do the wrong thing most of the time. And we have proven that right again and again. It took account of our sinfulness, of our appetite, of our ambition. It took account of the need in human affairs for balance from external forces, because so few of us have it internally. And the American Revolution itself is in many ways the great political embodiment of the idea, and for us, the reality, often observed more in the breach than the following, but still the reality, that reason should be able to have a stand against passion in the arena of public affairs. That's what the revolution was about. That's what the Constitution was about. And at our best, that's what the country has been about. The capacity to see that an openness to changing facts, to shifting circumstance, and a commitment to more broadly interpreting what Thomas Jefferson meant when he wrote what became the most important sentence in the English language, that all men were created equal, and as Susan B. Anthony added, and all women. When we broaden that definition, the eras in which we have broadened that definition have been the eras we wish to emulate and commemorate, not the ones where we've restricted it. Where we have opened our arms more widely, we have become stronger. And that is not a partisan point. I have voted for Democrats, I have voted for Republicans, I plan to continue to. It's a simple reading of the historical record to see that diversity is a strength, not a weakness, that open markets are a strength, not a weakness, that the free flow of goods and ideas and people are strengths, not weaknesses. That's not a partisan statement. It's simply the fact. And where we have to get in the country is a place where fact, once again, has the predominant role in our public life, as opposed to tribalism. If we had been here 50 years ago, in October of 1968, today, 46 Americans would have died in Vietnam. Not wounded, not captured, died. The year began with Tet, an offensive that pushed into Saigon and into the American embassy. We got to nearly 600,000 troops in the first part of 1968. It was a year, as we'll talk about, in which Martin Luther King was gunned down. Robert Kennedy was gunned down. Lyndon Johnson, who had been elected by the largest landslide in American history only 4 years before, was driven from office. Johnson had started his term in 1964-65 saying that these were the most hopeful times in the world since Christ was born in Bethlehem, which gives you some sense of Lyndon's sense of himself. The Chicago Democratic Convention disintegrates into violence. The year ends with the election of a Republican president over not only the Democratic nominee, but an independent candidate running on an explicitly segregationist platform who carries 5 states and 13.5% of the popular vote on a segregationist platform 50 years ago. So I'd rather be dealing with tweets than with Tet, all in all. Again, it's not to say, sit back, don't worry about what's going on now. But one of the points of history is to create a sense of proportion, a scale on which to judge the relative urgency of a given moment. And so let's talk for a little bit about 50 years ago, and you can decide where to rank this particular moment. What I hope you take away is that the year was shaped tragically by men with guns, but hopefully and wonderfully by a spirit embodied by those men who were killed, about the enduring journey, about the fact that we are always called in this country to believe in the equality of opportunity and to seek our better angels. And they would have it no other way. And so the greatest service we can do to their memory is to embrace the struggles of the present with what Franklin Roosevelt once called strong and active faith. So some ambient realities first. I'm sorry to report that the Cornhuskers went 3-4 in the Big Eight. Not good. Green Bay beat Oakland in Super Bowl II. Hair opened on Broadway. 60 Minutes debuted. Detroit beat the Cardinals in the World Series 4-3. Jacqueline Kennedy married Aristotle Onassis. The top TV shows. Laugh In was number one. Number two, Gomer Pyle, USMC. Number three was Bonanza, Mayberry RFD, Family Affair, Gunsmoke, Here's Lucy, Green Acres, Mission Impossible, My Three Sons, Lawrence Welk, and The Doris Day Show. The top movies were 2001 A Space Odyssey, Funny Girl, The Love Bug, The Odd Couple, Bullet, Rosemary's Baby, Planet of the Apes, Night of the Living Dead, very cheerful selections, The Lion in Winter, and John Wayne in that terrible The Green Berets. Remember that? Music, not a bad year. Otis Redding, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, number one. I Heard It Through the Grapevine, Marvin Gaye. Hey Jude by the Beatles. Jumpin' Jack Flash by the Rolling Stones. Hello, I Love You by the Doors. And Mrs. Robinson by Simon and Garfunkel. The best-selling fiction of the year, number one was Airport by Arthur Haley. Couples by John Updike. A John le Carré book, A Small Town in Germany. And then in a sign that things never really change, three of the top nonfiction books of the year were diet books. The Doctor's Quick Weight Loss Diet by Irwin M. Stillman and Sam Sinclair Baker. The Weight Watchers Cookbook and Better Homes and Gardens, Eat and Stay Slim. While gardening, I guess. I don't know. So that's where minimum wage was, I think, $1.60. Gas was less than $1 a gallon. And the world was changing all around us. So let's start in March. No one in the loop in Lyndon Johnson's White House on the last weekend of March in 1968 knew what he was going to do. He delivered his State of the Union address with a piece of paper in his pocket saying that he was not going to run for re-election. He wasn't sure whether he was going to do it. He wasn't sure when he was going to announce it, if he did. He had been hit very hard by Eugene McCarthy in the New Hampshire primary, and on the 16th of March, emboldened by Gene McCarthy's anti-war campaign, Robert Kennedy announced in the Senate caucus room, where his brother had announced 8 years before, that he was going to challenge his brother's own vice president for the Democratic nomination. Bobby was 42 years old. Johnson, battered by the war, believes that the promises of the New Frontier and the Great Society were irretrievably lost in the elephant grass and the humid jungles of Vietnam, realizes that he could force this through, but it was probably time. Lyndon Johnson was as political a man as ever drew breath. To relax, Nick Lemon once wrote, Johnson would call up and find school board races in Texas just to follow the results. That was how he unwound. It was an incredibly difficult decision, but the war was going to claim that casualty too. They scheduled a speech for Sunday night, the 31st of March. He spent that Sunday, he went to a Roman Catholic church with his daughter that morning. Terry Sanford, the former governor of North Carolina, was in the White House that day because he was going to be co-chairman of Johnson's campaign. Johnson dropped by a meeting with Sanford. Sanford left believing he had a campaign to run. When he found out later that night that Johnson had decided not to run, he realized that they had 15,000 LBJ and 68 bumper stickers to get rid of. But that night, in talking about the peace prospects in Vietnam, Johnson said, I will not seek and I shall not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president, ending in many ways the New Deal era in American politics. Lyndon Johnson had been a young congressman, elected in 36, under FDR, loved FDR. Hugh Seide, the great Time magazine columnist, once was with Johnson in the White House, and Johnson was rubbing a bust of FDR's face and said, strength, such strength in that face. He wanted to finish the work of Franklin Roosevelt at home. He wanted to finish the work of Lincoln on race, and in many ways had done so in 1964 and 65. But the promise of those years had been lost as the war spun ever more out of control. One of the signs that he would have to make the announcement he made that March night had come when Walter Cronkite, on the 27th of February, 3 weeks before, had anchored a one-hour special called Report from Vietnam. And it closed with the now fabled commentary where Cronkite said that the best solution he saw was that it was a stalemate and that an honorable people should begin to negotiate. There is an immense amount of scholarly debate about whether Johnson actually said, if I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America. But it's one of those things that might be true without being accurate. That was a sign that the era of consensus that had been born in the midst of the crisis and the cauldron of the Depression, FDR shifting the role of government, affirming the role of the state, and standing for American interests abroad with a wary eye on the home front, including states like this, which were not eager to join the fight in World War II. Johnson believed that he could cement the Roosevelt legacy and push it even farther. When he gave that speech that night, it really was, in many ways, the end of an era that had begun in 1932. It was the era that shaped so many of the lives of the people here and of their parents. It defined America's role in the world. It defined and helped set the stage for the building of the most remarkable middle class in the history of the world. It was under Roosevelt, it was under Truman, it was under Eisenhower. But without FDR's courage in the early 1930s, without his ability to save capitalism at a time when one out of four Americans were out of work, and there were live questions about whether capitalism could survive the decade, without Roosevelt, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, America as we know it, would not have existed the way it did when Johnson stepped up in the tragedy of Dallas. He expanded through the Great Society, government, to remarkable levels, setting up, as does every action in American public life, a reaction. He had gotten a message, even before Cronkite, that the country was not really the 60-40 country that had elected him in 64. We're always much closer to a 52-48 kind of country. The midterms of 1966, after Johnson's massive landslide in 64, led to 60 seats, I think, in the Republicans, for gains in the House. And the election in California of a guy named Ronald Reagan as governor. Johnson had had about the same amount of time as the preeminent figure of American politics from 64 to 66, as President Kennedy had as president between his inauguration and his assassination. It was about 1,000 days. And the reaction came. The Great Society was popular briefly. Then people began worrying about overreach. One step forward, two steps forward, one step back, a step to the side. It was, in fact, the nature of free government. We'd been doing this since the 1790s. The first campaign in American history to make America great again was in 1800, when Thomas Jefferson argued that we had fallen away from the first principles of the Revolution and we needed to return to the principles of 76. That was 8 years into the experiment. As Mark Twain once said, history may not repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. So Johnson had felt the chipping away. And he gives that speech, he pulls out of the race, Kennedy surges past McCarthy, stumbles past McCarthy, surge is a little strong. But it looks as though Kennedy will win the nomination. Humphrey is moving as fast as he can. It was set up to be a remarkable summer in Chicago. That was Sunday night, the last Sunday in March. 4 days later, the preacher at the Washington National Cathedral on the Sunday morning Lyndon Johnson had gotten out of the race was shot down at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. This is what Martin Luther King preached on the morning of Johnson's getting out of the race. From the Canterbury pulpit of the National Cathedral, King said, "There can be no gainsaying of the fact that a great revolution is taking place in the world today. In a sense, it is a triple revolution, with the impact of automation and cybernation." March 1968. "Then there is the revolution in weaponry. Then there is a human rights revolution with the freedom explosion that is taking place all over the world. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood. But somehow, in some way, we have got to do this. We must learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you cannot be what you ought to be unless I and what I ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it is structured." 4 days later, he was shot down. Riots ensued around America. It was one of the most consequential seven-day periods in American history, arguably as important, I would say, as the period between Sunday, December 7th, 1941, which Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, which ended on that Thursday, the 11th, with Hitler declaring war on the United States, and on the 12th with the United States declaring war on Nazi Germany. Close fight between those two periods for the most significant 7 days that changed everything. King's murder, he was 39, by the way, not yet 40 years old. The words in that sermon, the words that you know from the night before he was killed, when he said, "I may not get there with you, but I've been to the mountaintop. I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I've seen the promised land." That's the testimony we have to bear in mind. And it was a commitment to nonviolence in an era in which violence was so tempting. It would have been so much easier for Dr. King and John Lewis and Andrew Young to have embraced the more militant spirit that was on the side of the movement. But they did the rarest of things in a fallen world, in the political world. That's redundant. They stood by their principle. They had seen what happened. It wasn't pie in the sky. They had seen what happened. The Voting Rights Act was passed not least in the summer of 1965 because on March 7th, John Lewis and Hosea Williams were nearly beaten to death with network cameras running at the Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. That was the moment when Johnson said, "There are moments when the fate of a nation turns." So it was at Lexington, Concord, so it was at Appomattox, so it was last week in Selma, Alabama. If they had been fighting back, the moral high ground would have been lost. They were genuine martyrs. They were there willing to die for other people. As clear a case of martyrdom as St. Stephen. And they did it, their strength was because they did not fight back. And they bore witness, their protest from a position, the ultimate position of powerlessness, on the ground, on the asphalt, with Sheriff Jim Clark of Dallas County screaming for the troopers to advance on horseback with tear gas going and clubs. They were as powerless as anyone could be. But their powerlessness became the chief instrument of the deliverance of a people and a summons to all of us, people who looked like me from my native region, to understand that what Jefferson wrote was not limited, but illimitable. And we became stronger. What is our immigration issue in this country? Our immigration issue is that people want to come here. We're not doing very well when they arrive at the border at the moment, to say the least. Why, by what possible logical argument is diversity a weakness? There is none. People commemorate the Selma to Montgomery March. They commemorate Martin Luther King, who was murdered in Memphis. They commemorate Rosa Parks, who refused to get up on the 1st of December, 1955. Nobody commemorates the Klan. Nobody commemorates the white supremacist agenda. No one commemorates hate and fear. We commemorate love and hope. That's what the country does. It's what we have to keep doing. That night in Indianapolis, Robert Kennedy, wearing his brother's overcoat, stood up on the back of a truck R.W. Apple of the New York Times had told him the king had been killed in Memphis. Kennedy got up and said this to a almost entirely African-American audience who had not heard, there were no notifications on the phone, had not heard the news until Robert Kennedy told them. Here's what Bobby Kennedy said. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence or lawlessness, but love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, be they white or be they black. We can do well in this country. We will have difficult times. We've had difficult times in the past. We will have difficult times in the future. Let us dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. 2 months and one day later, walking through the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel, Robert Kennedy was shot to death. At that point, Mrs. Kennedy, soon to become Mrs. Onassis in the autumn, said that she had had a premonition and believed that the country was collapsing. It was a widespread view. The institutions that we believed in, politicians, public leaders, political parties, all seemed to be falling apart. It happened in Chicago, Hubert Humphrey fighting for the nomination. It happened with the violence and the riots across the country in the wake of the assassinations. And all along this disastrous cascading year, two men warily circled each other in search of the Republican nomination for president. Richard Nixon and the governor of California, Ronald Reagan. Reagan actually won more popular votes in the presidential primaries of 1968 than Richard Nixon did, because he won California. I never met President Reagan. It's one of my great regrets. I've been lucky enough to spend time with all the presidents of my lifetime except him. But I did get to know Mrs. Reagan a little bit, and she's the only woman I've ever met who ordered a third of a Cobb salad for lunch. It was very, I didn't know you could do that. And she always knew more gossip than I did about Washington, which she was 90 years old and living in Bel Air. It made me feel very insufficient. But I said to her once, after she'd had some good gossip and I had nothing to offer back, what is the great phrase associated with President Reagan, right? That we are a shining city on a hill. And most people think that that came from the Sermon on the Mount. But it didn't. It came from Ronald Reagan. Jesus says, city upon a hill. And Reagan, with that wonderful visual imagination, inserted the word shining. He improved on the image. And so I said to Mrs. Reagan, I said, you know, I've always been struck by the President Reagan's capacity to frame reality in the way that great performers and great presidents have to do. And I said, you know, this is true, I have heard ministers from the pulpit say, as Jesus said, we shall be as a shining city upon a hill, which he didn't. And I said, you know, he improved on Jesus, ma'am. And she looked and she said, well, yes, that's the kind of thing Ronnie did. May we all be loved as Nancy Davis loved Ronald Reagan. The Nebraska primary, do y'all remember this? On the 14th of May, played a role in this. You all liked Nixon. I don't know if you want to confront that or not, but 70% voted for Nixon, but 22% for Reagan, which was pretty high, actually, for that. Nixon ran a campaign in which he argued that law and order was essential, that we had reached a point of chaos, that the American system that seemed to be falling apart in Johnson's failure to ultimately deliver the Great Society at the same scope and scale of the New Deal, that there was an establishment answer to the crack-up of the Democratic establishment, and that was the Eisenhower-Nixon-Rockefeller world. Nixon could no more be nominated by the Republican Party today than my Springer Spaniel. My Springer Spaniel might have a better shot because she's registered to vote in Tennessee. It's possible. Possible. Fake bark. Anyway, the essential thing about the 68 campaign is that it's actually, we've been talking about tumult and we've been talking about tragedy. But the 68 campaign, the result of it, is actually not a bad place to draw some hope. It was a rough campaign. Roger Ailes was involved. There's a great debate about the nature of the Southern strategy, all of that. But it was Richard Nixon who was fending off George Wallace, and it was Hubert Humphrey who was fending off George Wallace. Wallace did extremely well, particularly among young white men. I have a project I want to do at some point. I'd like to find out how many Wallace voters in 68, I don't know how they voted in 16. It's a great, actually, they're academics here. Y'all go do that and send me the results. But the exit polling proves that. It's easy to be dispirited about the politics of 68. People tend to think that's the beginning of race baiting, and it's all terrible. I have a slightly different view, and that is based on the fact that 86.5% of the country, 86.5% of the country voted against George Wallace. Nixon won 43.4% to 42.7%. Nixon, until 72, my God, that guy just fought everything as close as he could. Nebraska, by the way, you all were stalwart for Nixon, 59.8%, but 8.4% of you voted for Wallace. So maybe the 5% of the Rockefeller people could have a reconciliation commission with the 8.4%. But what kind of president was Nixon? We now only see him through the prism of Watergate, understandably. It'll be that way forever. But think about what he did. He created the EPA. He signed the Clean Air Act. He made Earth Day part of our lives. He went to China. Right now, that's not a great thing, given the way things are going, but, you know, he tried. Nixon was a genuinely tragic figure in the Shakespearean sense of tragedy because he had the capacity for greatness and was brought low by essential characteristics. He was driven to do great things by an insecurity and a desire to make his mark and to matter in the world, that the son of a failed grocer from Whittier could do the same great things that Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and Jack Kennedy did. But that insecurity, that drive, made him paranoid and illegal. That's true tragedy, is that he had the capacity for greatness. Open question about whether we're facing that again. But I think if we're going to put our moment in context, we have to deal with 68. I think we have to deal with Reconstruction and the victory of white supremacy over those who were trying to make the verdict of Appomattox one of equality, embodying the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But again, my native region fought a rearguard action. We have to understand that period. We have to understand the period in the 20s when 3 to 5 million Americans were members of the Klan. The governors of Indiana, Colorado, Oregon, Texas, and Georgia were members of the Klan. The governor of Georgia told a Klan convention in Kansas City that he wanted to build a wall of steel as high as heaven to keep Southern Europeans out. We have to understand the 1950s when a rabble-rousing client of Roy Cohn's understood how to use the media to take over the right wing of the country and ride it to national prominence. May not repeat itself, but it rhymes. Margaret Chase Smith, Senator from Maine, gave a speech 3 months after McCarthy's first speech on communism. She called it the Declaration of Conscience. She laid out the exact case against McCarthy. It took the men 4 years to catch up. At least they caught up. And we have to understand 68. It was the end of so much, but it was the beginning of so much. The anti-war protesters who fought to end a war that in many ways perhaps should not have been started. I say this with enormous personal context. My father fought in Vietnam. He was in the 4th Infantry Division in Pleiku, Purple Heart, and never talked about it. It clearly shaped his life entirely afterward. He would occasionally broadly allude to demons, but he believed that he was doing what his father before him had done in fighting tyranny abroad. Vietnam changed the country in ways that we are still dealing with. George Wallace's campaign and also his defeat shaped the country we live in now. Dr. King's legacy shapes the country we live in now. Robert Kennedy's hard-headed liberalism would like to shape the country we live in now. The Democratic Party, if they make a comeback, I would venture to predict, will do so not with a far-left figure, but with someone more in the Robert Kennedy tradition of a kind of pragmatic liberalism. The National Organization for Women established a political committee in 1968 to support and campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment, which was essentially part of the mainstream of the conversation for 12 years. The Republican platform in 72 and in 76 supported the ERA. There's something to dazzle your neighbors with later. It was mainstream thought. The goodness, the best of us can be seen in that year. The worst of us can be seen in that year. And that's the way, to paraphrase Dr. King, that's the way history is made. And what we have to do is put ourselves in Mrs. Kennedy's shoes. She thought it was all coming apart. And yet here we are, defending again against forces, insidious forces, that seem to be conspiring against the institutions that have endured pretty well. But let's not sentimentalize the past. Trouble did not start on Election Day 2016. To sentimentalize the past is to do two things, I think. It does a disservice to the people who fought to get us where we are, and it forecloses the possibility of learning from it. Because if everything was perfect and sepia-toned, and everyone was wearing a frock coat or a tricorn hat, and everything was okay, then why would we study it? We study it because it was, as Wellington said of Waterloo, the damnedest close-run thing you ever saw in your life. And so will this. So the year ended, and I will end, on a note of hope. Christmas Eve, 1968, in the most watched broadcast in the history of the world, the greatest moment of communal activity until the next July, Apollo 8 entered lunar orbit. Remember? What did they say? What did Frank Borman and James Lovell and the other fellow's name I can never remember? He just went to the moon. Why do we have to remember? What did they do? They read the first 8 verses of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God called the dry land earth, and God saw that it was good. Thank you.